Hello, and welcome to the podcast edition of Ron Kaplan's Baseball Bookshelf, your source for news, reviews, previews, and interviews with baseball writers and authors, artists and musicians, filmmakers, basically anyone who has anything to do with baseball and pop culture. Because that's our slogan. If it fits on a bookshelf, it fits here. This is a wonderful age we live in. A decade ago, I never would have been able to meet someone like Gary Sierdkowski, the artist who created the Infinite Baseball card set, an author of the newly published The League of Outsider Baseball, an illustrated history of baseball's forgotten heroes. I've known Sierdkowski for several years thanks to email. It's one of those situations where we've never met face-to-face, or even talked on the phone prior to this conversation. But I know him for a dedicated fan, marvelous researcher, and darn good at his craft. The information about the players on the backs of the cards are, by necessity, brief, so his book allows him to show off those research and storytelling chops. The fact that he's been able to expand on the original premise of his work is a boon for those who love art, baseball, and discovering things a bit off the wall, and I'm glad he's getting some of the recognition he deserves. Gary Sierdkowski, welcome to the Baseball Bookshelf.
Oh, thanks for having me on.
Now, I'm just curious, you've been doing the cards for your Infinite Baseball card set for some time now. So this is kind of a chicken and egg thing. Did you always in the back of your mind have an idea that you would turn these into a book at some point?
No, not at all. The whole thing kind of came out of when my father passed away. We used to talk about baseball constantly, and when he passed away suddenly and right before the 2009 World Series, I didn't have anybody. I was living in Hollywood, and none of my friends were baseball fans, so I didn't have anybody to talk about baseball with, especially baseball history. So I started this little website, just a little blog, and I would draw a picture of a ball player, usually an obscure ball player, and write a little story about it. And I just did it for myself. I wasn't looking to do a book or, even become like a blogger or anything. I kind of just did it because I was lonely and I missed my father. And the book just kind of grew out of there.
Now, you often, and we've been corresponding for years, we were talking before we started this, and we've been corresponding for some time, and this is the first time we're actually talking, and you've frequently mentioned to me and on the site and in other venues the relationship you had with your father, and that is such a typical Americana, fathers and sons doing the baseball thing, that it's quite endearing.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, it is, like you said, typically American. My father learned baseball from his father, my grandfather was a first generation, his family came over from Poland. So he learned the game of baseball, when he lived in Brooklyn to become an American.
Right.
That was his way of mixing with everybody else and to become part of the new culture.
Now, the players you pick, you mentioned that they're fairly obscure. I mean, you do have a few who are quite familiar to even the most casual of baseball fans. But even those, you do not put them in the uniform in which they became famous. I'm thinking of, let's say, for example, Sandy Koufax.
Yeah, actually, I started the book off with him because everybody knows Sandy Koufax. He's, the greatest left-handed pitcher of all time. But I really like the stories about these guys before they got famous. Where did they come from? Sandy Koufax, of course, was from Brooklyn, and he played basketball and baseball when he was in high school. But he went to the University of Cincinnati not to play basketball or baseball, but to become an architect. That was his dream. And I thought that was completely fascinating that when the Brooklyn Dodgers actually wound up signing Sandy out of the University of Cincinnati, he made sure he signed for a bonus that was large enough to cover the rest of his architecture school as a fallback, because that's what he really wanted to be, was an architect. And, it's stories like that that I've always been fascinated with.
Now, give us an example of some of the, well, let me come back to that. How long does it take for you to create an artistic rendering like this?
Well, the drawing itself is very fast for me. That's what I do for a living. I do a black outline of the players, and then I take that drawing, the hand drawing and ink drawing, and I scan it into the computer and just drop different colors behind it. So I kind of got it so it was very simple to do, because I started this out not as a job or with anything else in mind. It was just something I did for fun, so in my spare time. So I did I came up with a style that would be fairly quick for me to do, that, but that was still visually appealing. But the drawing, it's the whole thing from start to finish, usually takes, you know, maybe 2 hours, or sometimes a little bit more, sometimes a little bit less. But the thing that takes the most time is I try to get the uniforms as accurate as possible, and the colors, and, you know, what teams looked like back then. And that actually takes longer than the drawing, just the research into old newspapers to try to find photographs.
I'd imagine so, especially since the earlier players, you can only find them in black and white.
Yeah, like the Sandy Koufax drawing that I did, for instance. I depicted him on the playing for the University of Cincinnati. It took me the longest time to get a picture of what the jerseys looked like that they wore at University of Cincinnati in 1954. And a friend of mine is a librarian at Xavier University here in Cincinnati, and he was able to track down some old press photographs for me. And finally, you know, I was able to replicate that, which was, you know, for me it was a lot of fun to do that.
Now, you don't just do the drawings, you do the narrative as well. Now, when you're doing the narrative for the backs of the cards, you have a very limited amount of space with which to work. When you are writing a book or on your blog, you have much more leeway. Which do you enjoy more, and which is more challenging, the drawing or the research?
I guess it kind of goes hand in hand. You know, being an artist my whole life, you know, the art just kind of comes second nature to me. It's just, it's something I would do just in my spare time. The writing is more, I guess the writing might actually be more rewarding, because since the book, even before the book came out with the blog, a lot of people really liked the way that I wrote, which is, I try to do my writing like I'm sitting next to you in a bar. You know, I'm telling you about this player. It's very conversational. And I guess that actually means a lot more to me that I get compliments on my writing style more so than my artistic ability, because simply I'm an artist and that's what I do. So I would hope that I'm good at what my profession is. But the writing is a nice surprise.
Now, the book itself is broken down into, I believe, 7 chapters. So what I'd like to do is I'm going to mention the title of each chapter. You can describe, if you will, the meaning behind the title, like who's included. And just give one example of a player that you've included in that section.
Sure.
So okay. We'll start off with Bush Leaguers.
Well, that's, most of those guys are Hall of Famers, and but I wanted to show what they did before they got to the major leagues or before they were famous. One of my favorite players of all time is Joe Medwick, Joe Ducky Medwick. He's a Cardinals and Dodgers player from the 1930s. I think he's the last guy in the National League to win the Triple Crown in 1937. But when he was in the minor leagues in Houston back in the early 30s, he was such a popular player that the team actually came out with a candy bar named after him. So I tell the story of that, which I thought was pretty interesting, that Medwick is one of only, I guess, 3 people to play baseball that had a candy bar named after him. The other two being Babe Ruth and Reggie Jackson.
Well, I mean, the legend goes that the candy bar wasn't actually named for Babe Ruth, but Baby Ruth was the daughter of some president. It was at Grover Cleveland, I don't remember. But that was one of those big controversies, is who's the candy bar named after. But I think in some, like, smaller regions that they were, I know there were cereals named after some players and other confections. Ted Williams, I believe, has a cake company named after him. But moving on to the next chapter, could have beens.
Yeah, you know, those are the guys that had all the ability in the world, and something just happened along the way. The guy I started off with is Steve Dalkowski, who was a pitcher in the Orioles minor league system from the late 50s through the early 60s. And they say he was probably the fastest pitcher of all time. It's just that he couldn't get it over the plate. And, you know, you read stories about this guy, and they seem like fiction, but when you start getting into the newspaper accounts, they actually happen. You know, like, there's one story where he threw a pitch and it tore part of the ear off of a batter. That's how fast it was. There's another one where he threw it went past the catcher, past the umpire, and right through the backstop, which was made out of solid wood. So, you know, I just kind of recount all these stories, you know, from his minor league career. It's just insane when you start reading this stuff. And, you know, the could have been part is that in the spring of 63, the Orioles finally were able to work with him. They had a young minor league manager by the name of Earl Weaver, who was able to harness this fastball for this guy. So he just tears through spring training with the Orioles in 63. He makes the team, Topps baseball cards. They send a photographer out. They take a picture of the guy. He's on a rookie card for the 63 set. But by the time the wax packs hit the stores, Tarkowski's gone, because in the final game before the season began, the final exhibition game, he blew his arm out, and that was it.
I'm sure there are a lot of stories like that.
Unfortunately.
All right, the next chapter is international game.
Yeah, that's one of my favorite ones. It was really interesting to see how the game spread across the world. You know, it's not just an American game, but you use Cuba, for instance. There's a player by the name of Nemesio Gio, and he was a student in the South in the United States in the 1860s. And when he graduated college, he went back to Cuba, and he brought a baseball and a bat with him. And that's the first baseball equipment that was brought into the island of Cuba. So he lived in Havana, and he taught baseball to all his friends, and they started a small team that kind of started to grow. And then in 1868, a revolution broke out in Cuba, and the Spanish colonial government saw this game of baseball as, you know, as an part of, you know, Yankee invasion of Cuba. So they banned the game of baseball and instituted bullfighting as the official game of Cuba. But in the meantime, this little game of baseball started to spread underground, and it was the young people's way of rebelling against the Spanish colonial government. So baseball for them, you know, whereas in America, it's a game, it's something fun. In Cuba at the time, it was to show that you were against the colonial government. It was a symbol of freedom. And I thought, you know, the story like that is just incredible.
And now we move on to the chapter titled Bad Guys.
Yeah, that's, you know, of course, a really fun one, because, you know, baseball just has tons and tons of disreputable characters throughout the years. And I kicked that one off with the Black Sox, the A players that were thrown out of Major League Baseball for fixing the 1919 World Series. And, you know, of course, Joe Jackson and Buck Weaver and Chick Gandel and those guys. And I've always been fascinated with not just the story of how they managed to throw a World Series, but what happened to them afterwards. You know, these were professional ball players. You know, when you read a book on the Black Sox, they usually kind of just stop after that and they don't say what had happened. But when you start looking at it, all these guys played baseball for many years afterwards, but they played it as mercenaries. They played for little town teams or outlaw leagues out in Arizona, you know, cowboy leagues and things like that. So those stories are just always fascinating me since I was a kid, and I was glad I was able to put those into the book.
And then we go to the People's Game.
And that chapter tells about people who are famous for something else, but how they had a love of baseball. Being from New Jersey, I put Frank Sinatra in there. He, when he was growing up in Hoboken, he was a Brooklyn Dodger fan. And then when they moved west to Los Angeles, he was an L.A. Dodgers fan, was always at the games. But during the 1940s and 50s, he had his own baseball team called the Swooners. And Anthony Quinn used to play for it, Nat King Cole. It was a revolving roster of Hollywood stars at the time. And they would play charity games against service teams and other stars or writers and people like that for charity.
And the next chapter is an important one. It's not that they're all not important, but this one is about the race game.
Yeah, I went back and forth on that chapter because I didn't want to make it just about the Negro League players. I didn't want to do what had happened to them before and segregate them into a separate chapter. So I kind of sprinkled those guys throughout the book in different places. But, you know, of course, there is Negro League players in there, but there's also other guys that had problems integrating the game for their religion or different ethnicities. There's a guy by the name of Moses Solomon, and at the time he was called the rabbi of SWAT, and he was playing for a team out in Kansas in Hutchinson in the early 1920s, and he hit a record number of home runs out there. So the New York Giants at the time used to be the best team in New York City. Everybody loved the New York Giants. Well, Babe Ruth comes to the Yankees, and all of a sudden the Yankees start taking away fans from the Giants. So the manager of the Giants, John McGraw, is just looking to find his own Babe Ruth. Now, at the time, there's a huge Jewish population in New York, immigrants, and they love baseball. So they're all flocking to the New York Yankees because it's a very exciting team. John McGraw not only wants to find a Babe Ruth, but he wants to find a Jewish Babe Ruth. So he sends his scouts all over the country trying to find a Jewish Babe Ruth, and they stumble upon Louis Solomon, who's hitting all these home runs out in this little minor league team in Kansas. And they wind up bringing him up to the New York Giants. He plays two games, and he winds up getting sent down to the minors because of an altercation with John McGraw. And he's also a football player in the off season, and he winds up injuring himself, and that was the end of his career, essentially.
Again, another example of a career being ended prematurely by injury. And you wrap up the book with Oddballs, which is probably my favorite chapter.
Yeah, there's just, you know, baseball history is just so rich in these type of characters. Man, I don't even know where to start on this one. You could take a character, you could start off with Mo Berg. I mean, he's kind of like the king of the baseball oddballs. Probably the strangest guy ever to put on a baseball uniform, and probably the most brilliant. He studied at Princeton University, was expert in many different languages. He was the type of guy that could have graduated Princeton and gone on to do anything in his life, but he loved baseball. And he wound up playing for the Brooklyn Dodgers as an infielder, and was a mediocre ball player, but he managed to stretch out this major league career for almost 20 years. And in the offseason, while a lot of players would go hunting or fishing or have a job in the offseason to supplement their income, Berg would travel the world or take classes at the Sorbonne in Paris. He was just it's one of the players I would really like to sit down and talk to. But he's most famous for a tour that he went on to Japan with Babe Ruth and a bunch of all-stars. There's the famous story where he disguised himself as a Japanese woman and went to the top of the tallest building in Tokyo and took a 360-degree panoramic shot of the Tokyo skyline, which was later used during World War II for bombing raids.
That's always been a fascinating story. I can never get enough of Mo Berg. In thumbing through the book, I know you've mentioned this before, your choice of uniforms. Is depicting a major league uniform at any point an issue?
I think there's something when you put it in a book, for some reason with publishing, it's not like you're trying to make money off of the New York Yankee logo or something like that. When it's in the book and part of a collection, I believe it has something to do with it's a part of something bigger. It's not the thing that is attracting people to buy the book, or you're not trying to make money off of it.
So there's no issue for you with licensing or permissions or anything?
For the book, no. Not that I know of.
Mm-hmm. And excuse me. As you said, this book is getting quite a bit of great publicity, and congratulations are in order for you receiving the Tony Salen Memorial Award from the Baseball Reliquary.
Oh, thanks. That was a big honor. I found that out a couple of days before the book actually hit the stores, so it wasn't. It was even nicer because it wasn't based on the fact that I had a book that was being published. It goes back to the work that I've done over the years on my website and just the stories and the illustrations that I had done. So, yeah, I was sitting on a plane on the tarmac, and I got the email, and it was just a huge surprise. It's a big honor. I'm still kind of shocked by it.
Now, the Baseball Reliquary, for those out there who haven't heard the name before, is a collection of fans who are in it for the love of the game, not especially to follow the superstars like the Roots and the Koufaxes, but some of these unsung players that you highlight in your book. The award is presented annually to an individual for his or her commitment to the preservation of baseball history, and this is rather than the standard narrative nonfiction book. This is a unique way to present it.
Yeah, to me, it's always the Baseball Reliquary has kind of been kind of like the People's Hall of Fame. It's not as political, or just not as many guidelines as the Hall of Fame in Cooperstown. This is more like for the fans, and that's really what really means a lot to me that the board of directors awarded me this year.
Now, but based on the success of this book, do you have any plans for a follow-up?
I have about 6 or 7 ideas for follow-ups. It depends on how, you know, how well this sells. If it does sell, you know, hopefully it does. I have tons of different ideas, different directions I can go. You know, when I turn the manuscript in for this, it's the book is 240 pages. I think there's about 130 different illustrations and stories inside of it. I think I was about 120 pages over when I handed in the manuscript. So, I mean, right off the bat, I have, you know, at least half of another book already, you know, already finished. And with baseball history, there's just so many of these characters. You could just keep going and going and going for forever, for infinite.
Now, that's one of the hardest things for any author to do. You have such a wealth of information. It turns out to be too much. You know, how do you do surgery? How do you excise and cut it down to a palatable amount? You know, these cards are actually available as card sets, correct?
No. Every once in a while, I'll do a couple. I have a Pete Hill card set. Pete Hill was an old Negro League player from the turn of the century up to the 1920s, and I worked with his nephew and another baseball historian, and we did a 15 card set of his life, and that's available on my website. But the other cards, sometimes I'll produce them and I'll give them to collectors and things like that. But there's no big card set that's out.
Yeah, is that something you'd be interested in?
I'd have to team up with somebody that's a lot bigger than I am to actually do that. There's a lot of licensing issues and getting each player's permission. Like when I did the Pete Hill set, that was with his family and another writer that had done all the research for the, you know, for the writing and the statistics on the back, and I just did the design and illustration for that. So, you know, that's something, that was one player and, you know, the family was behind it, so that there was no issues with that. But if I was to do a big card set, which I would completely love to do, I mean, who wouldn't? you know, there's just so many different components that go into that and actually producing it and something like that. I'd have to team up with, you know, with some people that really knew what they were doing.
And what is your website?
if you just type in infinite card set infinite baseball card set, it'll pop right up on Google, and you can see a lot of the illustrations, and not so much the ones that are in the book, but ones that are just like it, and you can see where the book came from.
And we've been talking with Gary Sierczkowski, the author of The League of Outsider Baseball, an illustrated history of baseball's forgotten heroes. Gary, thanks so much for talking with us today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me on, Ron.
And that was the Bookshelf interview with Gary Sierczkowski. Tune in again next time, and our guest will be Josh Leventhal, author of A History of Baseball in 100 Objects. And remember, for the latest news, reviews, previews, and interviews, come back often to Ron Kaplan's BaseballBookshelf.com and drop me a line at ronkaplansbaseballbookshelf@gmail.com. Thanks, everybody. See you next time.
Pitching that fader so grand, he'd have said, "Boys, I'm glad I discovered this land. Cheers."